You're listening to EAA Radio. I'm Afterburner Al. Welcome to our Aviation Journalist Roundtable, the third annual. And I don't know if that really is notable for anything, but I'm sure happy that both of these guests I have in the studio have come back for a third year. First, Tom Haynes, who's the editor of AOPA Pilot Magazine, and Mac McClellan, who is the editor of Flying. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Well, just like the first Aviation Journalist Roundtable we had, this was the T6 Texans were making a lot of noise where we're talking, and now it's, can you see what's running back and forth?
Yeah, they're F5s.
Oh, okay. Well,
wherever they came from, I had no idea.
It feels like they're coming from right behind me, and I'm going to duck every time once in a while. But since we had the arrival of the A380, I'm going to quick touch on one topic, and that is the relevancy of such a large aircraft. And do you think Airbus, after, I believe if I read the stat right, there's about 17 in service, is this going to be something similar to what Boeing had with 747 when it rolled out in the late 60s or not?
Probably not. I think that the airline scheduling practices have broken up enough that medium and short haul and thinner routes, as they call them, between city pairs, is going to lower the demand rather than hub to hub that was the focus when the 747 was introduced. So I think the Airbus 380 is going to be on specialized routes, you know, long distance routes, Asia, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we'll make one comment about having it here. I mean, anybody who thinks that maybe it's inappropriate that a huge airliner be here at what is, you know, for the most part, a general aviation show is wrong. Because I think it's great to have things like that here that are curiosities that inspire people.
I've always thought about that after seeing just the upper deck of a 747 and wondering, well, why don't you just, you know, give it a second floor? What would that look like? And sure enough, yeah, here we are. I think the one comment that was made was that the reason that the 747 is so distinctive is because that second floor ends after a certain time, and so you have the kind of the flowing lines on the top there. And whereas this, it looks like a London bus.
It is huge.
We've had a change in the White House, and of course we've had a change at the head of the FAA. I'd like to touch first in general on what a White House does to transportation policy, and specifically the FAA. Tom?
Well, the Obama administration has definitely, through Secretary LaHood, made it clear that they have a couple of initiatives, at least regarding air transportation, that they want to get done, one of which was to get the air traffic controller situation straightened out and get NextJet in place. So I think that the FAA has pretty clear marching orders directly from the White House to get those things done.
Has the last couple of administrators been kind of caretaker administrators, in your opinion, Mac?
Well, they certainly were not aviation people. Neither one had worked directly in the industry. So that brought a different, more bureaucratic attitude, I think. Not that they were not necessarily effective, but they certainly weren't providing any vision. I think the Obama administration overall is not particularly hostile towards aviation, any form of it, but I think they're probably one of the perhaps least informed or involved that we've had in a long time. High-speed rail, you know, very prominent in their thinking. Certainly they're aware of highway issues, congestion on freeways, and the rest of the infrastructure. So I think aviation is probably a little further back in the pecking order with this group than some of the previous administrations.
This is an administration within the government, and generally, even if you do have, you know, the presidents come and go, it is an agency. Many of our agencies do have to operate somewhat on their own. How much guidance does the FAA get from the White House, or is it always passed through the Department of Transportation?
I think it, except for maybe a few very specific issues, it's mostly all coming through the Secretary's office, and they're the ones that are executing the strategy out of the White House.
Would you have seen this pick, Randy Babbitt, for the new FAA administration or administrator coming? Or where in your mind, in picking an FAA administrator, would you have thought that they would have gone with someone like Randy Babbitt?
I think he's an excellent choice. And, of course, his name had been floated long before the current administration. And I think he's a very traditional pick, you know, someone who has had the government experience, the industry experience. I think it's as good as it can possibly be.
Well, his labor background really break the logjam with especially the controllers? Or was this more of a philosophy toward the controller contract, or was this something that had to do with Congress? Because I know Congress is on one side, but the administration was on the other side of the AGC contract. Will the new FAA administrator be in place really change all that?
I had so I ran into some controllers the other night in an event, and were asking them, you know, what they thought. They're actually here representing NATCA, and it was interesting to hear their perspective. Apparently, there was a period shortly after the administrator was sworn in where there was an opportunity for him to make a change to a situation that the controllers felt was pretty significant, which is apparently dividing up Miami approach control and tower. In the past, controllers have typically been able to work both approach and the tower, and the FAA has made some changes where in some locations they're starting to split that you either work the tower or you work approach. And the controllers don't like that, and they believe it's better to have people cross-trained. And that was about to be implemented in Miami, down in Miami, and the administrator had the opportunity when he first came in to put a stop on that and to at least take the time to understand the impact of that, and he didn't do it. So the controllers felt like that was a bit of a slap in the face, and then maybe that was setting the tone for what it was going to be like with Randy Babbitt as the administrator. But on the other hand, they also said there have been signs and signals coming out of the FAA management that they do want to work with the union. They do want to try to resolve the issues that have been kind of brewing out there since back in the Bush administration.
We talked a little bit about some of the last year when we spoke. We talked a little bit about some of the issues that are coming up, like down in Dallas-Fort Worth, there was some real issues with managers and about manipulating, I think it was about manipulating traffic counts, or I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was pretty egregious. But certainly some of those issues were floating around, and that directly affected safety. Why haven't we gotten more pressure from Congress? It seems like, yes, the tension between the administration and the controllers was palpable, but really there was no outside pressure to move it in one way or another, and it's been kind of languishing for quite a while.
I think the controllers have fallen into that ideological split where the anti-union, anti-labor members of Congress see them as the poster child of unreasonable union demands. And, of course, the entire anti-labor movement cites the Reagan firing of the controllers in 81 as a watershed in the relations between labor and management. So I think that those issues ideologically overrule what would be more fundamental common sense issues of, hey, is this system working? You know, and it, of course, varies from region to region. The FAA regions have a lot of influence how the particular facilities in their region operate. And the individual person who's in charge of that facility could have widely different attitudes in how the working controller is treated. So to generalize, as with all things, FAA is impossible because there's really 22 centers, I believe it is, and many more TRACONs, and each one is somebody's little fiefdom.
Tom, what would, if there's a young person out there who wants to become FAA administrator, from a GA perspective, what should they do with their life in order to probably be one of the more effective administrators?
Well, that's a great question. I suppose it would be to sample as much of the aviation spectrum as you can. So it's a tough assignment.
And, of course, probably more than we would really like, some political connections also help as well.
I think they're essential. If you really wanted to be administrator, you would need to become active in one of the two parties and raise funds and do all the things we know advance the cause of a person in a bureaucracy, because... And no matter how much we wish that weren't true, it remains a political position, even with the 5-year appointment now mm-hmm. that hopes to bridge, obviously, the 4 years of an administration. It's still essential for the candidate to have been involved with the party in power.
We'll talk a little bit more about what Randy Babbitt should do, or our suggestions on what he should do as he takes control of the FAA. We'll do that after a break. You're listening to the Aviation Journalist Roundtable on EAA Radio.